The most recent buzzword lighting up social media and the news is immigration. With all the controversy surrounding President Trump's travel ban, what should the church be saying and doing? How can we understand the historical and biblical precedent for treatment of refugees? Hello, I'm your host, Sam Rohr, and today we'll be joined by Christian historian David Barton to uncover the historical facts about this most important issue.
Welcome to Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network Week in Review, featuring the best segments taken from our Stand in the Gap Today daily program. Our goal is to equip the pastor, church leader, and all believers to think critically and biblically in a culture that increasingly rejects truth. Stand by to hear a focused analysis of current events viewed through the lens of a biblical and constitutional worldview. The pastor's and the believer's goal should be to impact our culture for Christ. As part of our mission to urge pastors to boldly preach the whole counsel of God and equip people to be soldiers and ambassadors for Christ, we're establishing APN chapters in all 50 states. Learn more on the web at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. Now, here's our host and American Pastors Network President, Sam Rohr.
Welcome to today's program, and we're glad that you've joined us. We hope that you know that when you tune in to Stand in the Gap Weekend, you're going to hear the best discussions taken from our daily program on the latest news and issues confronting our churches, family, and nation. It's these issues that myself and my co-hosts, Evangelist David Kistler and Pastor Gary Dahl, address from a biblical and constitutional perspective. After spending 18 years in the House of Representatives for the state of Pennsylvania, I had the privilege and opportunity of examining and understanding the Constitution and its effect on our government and nation in a very distinct way. Many times I stood on the floor of the House and defended biblical and constitutional principles when issues were debated and history was made. We're now at one of those defining moments of our day and the understanding of not only the constitutional guidelines, but the biblical principles underscoring the treatment of immigrants must be applied. And that is why we're airing an interview that we did with David Barton on January the 27th regarding the intent and understanding on behalf of our founding fathers when they crafted the laws relating to immigration for our nation. David Barton is the founder of Wall Builders and an organization that presents America's forgotten history and heroes with an emphasis on our moral, constitutional, and religious heritage. I hope that you'll stay tuned because this may be one of the most important programs we've aired to date.
Well, ever wonder what our first president, President George Washington, the first Congress, our founding fathers perhaps would say about the cornerstone policies of our 45th president, Donald Trump, and his promise and his goal to make America great again? I have wondered that. And so today we're going to talk about that with the help of David Barton, historian, author, and leading authority on our founding fathers. And we're going to consult with our founding fathers with the help of David and look at two key components of making America great again. And these are the issues, that of vetting immigrants to America, and the other is building the wall on the border as a necessary piece of protecting our people and keeping us as a nation, a nation. And with that, I welcome you to Stand in the Gap today. This is Sam Rohr, and I'll be joined today by Dr. Gary Dahl. David Kistler is away from us today. And of course, then our special guest, personal friend, and friend of all of those who love liberty, David Barton, president of Wall Builders. David, welcome to Stand in the Gap today.
Hey, guys. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a thrill to have you, David. We have a lot to go over. You talk fast, so I know we're going to be able to get a lot done. So we'll charge right into it. Dave, President Trump has made popular the phrase, as we all know, make America great again. And from the building of the wall to now permitting the pipeline, to canceling the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to stopping the immigration process for unvetted immigrants, to threatening to slap tariffs on certain imported goods, to calling Islamic terrorists dirty, sneaky rats, all kinds of things. David, this has been one fantastically full week in Washington. Many people, they think it's extreme. To others, they say, wow, this is overdue good news. But I'd like to go into one thing that the president said last night in an interview with Sean Hannity. And this one had to deal with the matter of extreme vetting in regard to immigrants. I want to play this short clip, and I want to come back and ask you what you think President George Washington and her founders would have thought or said about controlling immigration, and if they would have agreed with the concept of extreme vetting. Can you play the clip, Russ?
Let's talk a little bit about the executive orders on Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen, and 120 ban. That goes to the promise of extreme vetting.
Totally extreme. Explain. And beyond just those countries, we're going to have extreme vetting. We're going to have extreme vetting for people coming in to our country. And if we think there's a problem, it's not going to be so easy for people to come in anymore. You look at what's gone on. I mean, we could just go one after another, but then you go to other countries and you look at Nice and you look at different places all over Europe and you look at what's happening with Germany. It's a mess. The crime is incredible. And we're just not going to let that happen here.
Would it be gambling if at some point when there is a procedure in place, if you can't ascertain whether or not somebody's been radicalized or not, or if radical groups actually train some of their soldiers to say the right things to get in. But if you can't positively ascertain they're safe and find out what's in their heart, does that mean no go? You won't gamble?
Well, I tell you what, you use the right word, gamble. We don't want to have gambles. Our country has a lot of problems, well beyond this. And I found out a lot over the last week. I mean, we have serious difficulties. We don't need another difficulty. Right now, the FBI has over 1,000.
All right, Dave, we could have gone on, but you get the, but you get the idea there. I'd like to ask you about that. What did George Washington and our founders think about immigration and controlling it, and what have they agreed with this concept of extreme vetting?
They were fairly open on immigration in one way. And let me say that back in the Declaration, one of the 27 grievances they had against King George III was that he was shutting down immigration. But immigration was also controlled. There was a process to it. And within that process, for example, when you get to the time of Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson talks about what is the federal government's role in immigration. And he said the federal government's role in immigration is to make sure that those that come to America are healthy and that they don't have any diseases, et cetera. But immigration was set by the states, not by the federal government. Because when you come to America, you don't live in the United States. You live in Pennsylvania, or you live in Texas, or you live in Florida, you live in Oregon. And so states are the ones that controlled so much immigration back in that period of time. And what you were looking for was someone who wanted to fit into what the nation was. And, you know, I hear Christians and pastors all the time say, well, you know, we have this thing in Leviticus that says, be kind to the stranger among you because you were once strangers in Egypt. And as my Hebrew rabbi tells me, he says, you Christians don't have a clue what that word means. That word is ger in Hebrew. And that means one who wants to come in and become one of you and conform to you and live according to your rules and laws. It's not somebody that just shows up at your border and say, I'm going to leave here. No, you have to say, I want to live according to your rules. I want to become one of you. I want to become a Jew, in other words. And that's a stranger. It's someone who was not born a Jew but wants to become a Jew. Okay, well, they weren't born Americans, but they want to become Americans. Well, we have too many here that don't want to become Americans. They want to come in here and continue their lifestyle and their culture, and they want to make us into them. And that's what our immigration was based on, was the biblical concept of come in and be part of us. I want to read you just a couple of sentences out of the 1919 immigration book. It was written by the chief of naturalization. And if you were coming to, and this is the end of World War One. So after World War One in Europe, you have this huge influx of immigration coming into America because of all the war. In 1941, they brought the book back out and reprinted it. And again, chief of naturalization, because at that time, you've now got Hitler starting to move across Germany. We're not in the war yet, but we're having this influx of immigrants coming in out of Poland, the Czechoslovakia, and elsewhere. And so here's what it says. You have to learn American history. You have to learn American government and culture, et cetera. And here's what they say about becoming an American. And this is the quote. This is the immigration policy after World War II. It says, an American is a man who is greater in his soul than in his class, creed, political party, or the section in which he lives. To be an American, a man must have an American soul and believe in the spiritual realities upon which America rests and out of which America was born. America was created to unite mankind by those passions which lift and not by the passions which separate and debase. We came to America to get rid of the things that divide and make sure of the things that unite. Now, there's nowhere close to that in our immigration policy today. that we're trying to make a culture, an American culture out of this, and spiritual realities of which we were founded. I mean, we're saying, hey, if you're a Christian coming out of Syria to persecute, we don't want you. But if you're a Muslim coming out of Syria, yeah, we're going to take you. We took 53 Christians in last year after declaring that a genocide. Only 53 Christians we allowed to enter the United States out of Syria. But we took tens of thousands of Syrian Muslims. I mean, it's crazy. And so that's what the founders would have said, because that's what our policy also was for the next 150 years after the founders.
Well, you know, you sort of answered two of the questions that I had, and we only have 10 seconds left. But I was going to ask you, David, where did that change of philosophy take place, where immigrants can be and can come into the United States and be as they want, rather than actually assimilating into our who we are, into our culture? But I think you have sort of answered that. Maybe you want to can comment on that again a little bit more after the break.
Let's hold that, Gary. Let's hold that, Gary and Dave. And when we come back, Dave, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get David to answer that specific question. And then we will move into the issue of the building of the wall and the maintaining of a border. What our founders think about that? What did they say about that key issue, which is right front and center right now? You are listening to Stand in the Gap today. Sam Rohr and Gary Dahl. And our very special guest, David Barton, author, historian, president of Wall Builders. We'll be right back with the next phase. Stay with us.
We're going to head now into our next segment with Christian historian David Barton on the subject of immigration. We've been talking about the historical underpinnings of the laws on immigration as originally envisioned by our founding fathers. Now, David made it clear that they clearly expected that those who came into our country as refugees or immigrants would be willing to assimilate to our culture and to become Americans by adopting our laws and our culture. Unfortunately, that's not the case for most of today's immigrants coming to the United States. In fact, we know that the majority of refugees coming from Muslim countries have been taught an ideology that will never accept Western ideals. In fact, as we've discussed many times on this program, the intent of every good, practicing, and mosque-attending Muslim is to establish Sharia law in every part of the world through jihad, no matter what it takes to do so. The next question we're going to discuss with David is how our view of immigration has changed and what our founding fathers would have thought of President Trump's promise to build a wall.
Well, David, let me go back now to this other issue. I want you to finish, I guess, the question we started on the other side of the break. Gary asked you a question. When did it change from the view of immigrants where we were looking for people who wanted to come and be Americans to now, into these age, almost bringing in people who do not ever want to become Americans but actually want to change America? When did that shift?
The seeds of that change began in education in the 1920s as progressives shifted the way we taught. Prior to that point in time, we taught about individuals. We did not look at groups. We looked at individuals. Every individual had God-given inalienable rights. Every item in the Bill of Rights is given to every individual. It's not given to groups. Today, the Supreme Court says the purpose of the Bill of Rights is to protect the minority from the majority. Now, how stupid is that? Because I'm in the majority as a white guy, do I not get the right to a trial by jury? Do I not get the right to have free speech? No, because I'm in the wrong group. And so what happens is even back in 1992 in a Supreme Court case that's involved with the court at that time said that created classes of religions. And if you're in Christianity, that's the biggest religion, so we give you the least protection. But if you're in a small religion, we'll give you more protection than anyone else. No, no, no. Everybody gets the same protection because it's inalienable rights to every individual. Rights don't go to groups, they go to individuals. In the 1920s, the progressive step in education made four major changes, but one of which was they put us into age-graded education. We used to say, whatever you know, that's how we group you. So you could be 14 years old in the first grade, or you could be 12 years old in the eighth grade. But we started saying, no, if you're 12 years old, we put all 12 years old together. And so it started the process of what we now know as identity politics. In D.C., we got to know whether you're straight or gay, whether you're union or right to work, or you're liberal, or you're conservative, or you're moderate, or are you a senior, are you black, are you white, are you brown, or what are you? We don't know how to treat you until we know. And then we did that with the passing of the income tax. We don't treat everybody the same taxation-wise. Now we have five categories of taxation. We got to know which group you fit into before we know how to treat you. And so that's what we do with immigration now. It's a progressive view that we have to know your group. We have to know what your beliefs are. We have to know what group you're part of before we know how to treat you. And that's the product of something that was introduced in the 1920s as the progressives started taking government.
Excellent, Dave. Now, I'm going to go right now into we had a clip to play, but because of the time, I'm going to forego the clip. But the president last night was talking with Sean Hannity, and he talked about the issue of building the wall and the importance of it protecting the people and all of that. Let's go right now into this question. What would a President Washington and any of the founders have said about the importance of a border, the importance of a wall? Obviously, there wasn't a need for it back then, we know, but what would have they thought in matter of principle relative to this discussion today?
You know, I was at the inauguration in D.C., and a lot of the protesters there were on the immigration issue and the wall, et cetera. And the way I would go at it, and the way I think the founders would explain it best, is for somebody who says, we need an open border on immigration, my question would be, do you have locks on your house? Do you leave your keys in your car? And if they said no, I would say, why not? Do you think that belongs to you? I mean, why do you stop anyone from coming into your house? Don't you want everyone to share your house? Don't you want everyone to use your car? See, the concept of borders is private property. It goes back to a biblical concept in the book of Acts where it says that God lays out the lines of nations. Nations are their own private property. They have borders. God lays out those borders. And to say that there's open borders is the same as saying, there's no locks on my house. I want anybody to come in and stay. Well, even progressive liberals don't buy that. They want their house protected. Well, that's the same thing a border is. What it is this is our country, this is the country that we have, and we control this country according to these laws, and no, we are not global. We are distinct, separate nations. And so that's where the founders were, and that's why George Washington told us very seriously in his farewell address to avoid foreign entanglements. When you start bringing in all these foreign aspects, you lose your character and identity as Americans. He talked about how important it was to preserve the nature and character of an American, how distinct we were among the nations of the world, and that we were to maintain that distinctness. And that is a biblical concept. And so that's why everybody in the 12 tribes can tell you what tribe they're from. They maintain their distinctness, and they know their tribes. And we've got this progressive idea where that, no, we want everybody in groups. And by the way, we don't want any distinct identities out there. So with that, the individuality goes away, and that affects, again, your immigration as well.
Dave, I think that that's a very good explanation. And, of course, you brought in the matter of Acts chapter 17, which we have spoken a lot about here on this program as it relates to borders. And, of course, you know, as Donald Trump has said, a nation without borders is no nation at all. But beyond the idea of borders, what other characteristics of a nation did our founders understand and build within the framework of our Constitution? There are other issues that go along with what makes a nation, correct?
There are, and that nation has got to be founded on common beliefs, common purposes. That's why Washington talked about what it was to be an American, and then in his farewell address, he listed about a dozen different philosophical ideas that made America unique from other locations. He specifically pointed to Europe and said, do not let that philosophy come here because you'll no longer be Americans. And one of the things he pointed to specifically was in Europe, they think that you can be moral without religion. They think that education is capable of teaching morality. In America, we know that's not true. We know that you will not separate morality or religion from government or from public affairs and maintain a strong nation. And so it's those kind of beliefs that made us different. He was watching the French Revolution, all the other revolutions that were happening at the time. That was called the Age of Revolution. And they were all so enlightened that if you just teach the right thing, people will do the right thing. And he said, that's not true. We know that it takes faith in God to do the right thing. And then we also specifically taught the Declaration of Independence. We don't teach that today. We don't even teach the Constitution. But the founders believe you would never understand the Constitution if you didn't master the Declaration.
That's right.
So if you look in early law books, for the first 8 years of school in America, you were required to take a written exam for the first 8 years of school on four separate documents. You had the Constitution, you had the Declaration, you had the state Constitution, Washington's farewell address. If you mastered that, you had the American philosophy. And if you look at the Declaration, it starts with 155 words that set forth the entire philosophy of American government and six principles. And of those six principles, four of the six are absolutely God-centered. And if you don't get that right, you don't get the philosophy of government right. So that's what made us distinct, is unlike being a Jew or being a German or whatever, you're born there, therefore you are in America. You're an American because you adopt a certain philosophy. You can come from any country and be an American if you'll become part of that philosophy. And so even back then, we recognized the distinctness that we were. We encouraged immigration as long as you came wanting to be part of this philosophy, wanting to fit in and contribute. We were open immigration to those people.
David, we only have just a little bit left here in this section, but the whole issue of the issue of sovereignty and what we see happening in Europe and the whole continent, make America great again. In your opinion, is this a good thing that we're witnessing, or is this a problematic thing that we're witnessing?
I think it's a good thing we're witnessing. I have talked to cab drivers in England for a long time, and I like cab drivers because they're more aware politically of what's going on. And they are so wanting their own character back as a nation. Open immigration there has filled their nation with people who want to destroy their nation. They like being the British nation, and that's their sovereignty and independence.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Stand in the Gap today. Our special guest, David Barton of Wall Builders, Gary Dull and myself here. When we come back after this break, we're going to go to the issue of now a biblical worldview and challenges to it. What are those biblical principles that our founders embraced that we need to re-embrace today?
We're glad you're listening to today's Stand in the Gap weekend. Did you know that the American Pastors Network produces not only Stand in the Gap Today and Stand in the Gap Weekend, but also a one-minute program carried on over 200 stations nationwide called Stand in the Gap Minute? Here's the program from last week. I hope that you enjoy this important challenge. The immigration controversy has become deeply divisive. Is it right for government to deny access to some would-be immigrants? Does God's Word provide clarity? The answer is yes. Hello, I'm Sam Rohr with the American Pastors Network and another timely Stand in the Gap Minute. In my previous program, we learned that God's command to welcome immigrants was conditional on the would-be immigrant agreeing to assimilate and accept the God of heaven, not fight against him. A second principle to understand is that government's duty to God and the citizen is different than the church's duty. While the church's role is to care for the sick and reach out to those who do not yet know our God, government's duty in Romans 13 is to enact justice, enforce the law, and protect the citizen. That's why God gave civil government the sword of justice. God's Word does hold all the answers if we but read and do it. The American Pastors Network, pastors preaching the truth, equipping the saints for service. Visit us at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net to find out how you can help. Welcome back. If you just joined us, we're talking about immigration the way our founding fathers would have understood it. David Barton, founder of Wall Builders, has been giving us a history lesson on how our laws address this issue. Now, in this next segment, we'll be talking about education and how the progressive movement changed the way people understood or understand our most fundamental document, the Constitution of the United States of America. Unfortunately, the lack of teaching in the church and the dumbing down of our educational system is now coming back to haunt us with a generation of people who no longer understand the basic biblical and constitutional principles upon which our nation was built.
Well, welcome back to Stand in the Gap today. Sam Rohr, Gary Dull, and our special guest today, David Barton. Dave, I want to continue now in this vein of looking at our founding fathers, what they would have thought, and how they would approach the concept of Make America Great Again. We've talked on the aspect of immigration. We've talked and we just dealt with the issue of borders and common beliefs and language, that kind of thing, what makes a nation a nation. But our founders really understood, as you said, there were six principles. They didn't talk about Bible verses all the time because people had a very broad understanding of biblical principles. Yet today, I think we're pretty sparse on understanding of biblical principles. I know you do, Dave, and you do a lot of speaking on it. I would like you to explain, if you could, identify what you would say would be the most, I guess, essential elements of biblical principles, biblical worldview. Tie these things together, if you could, and lay this out so our folks have an understanding of what it really rests upon. You know what I'm saying? Just charge into this because you can speak hours, but I don't have hours, so go ahead.
Right. The biblical worldview really stems from knowing the Bible. You can't think Bible if you don't know Bible, and that's the biggest problem we have right now. Of Christians in America, only 14% read the Bible on a daily basis. If you don't know what's in the book, you can't act like what's in the book. And so polling shows that only about 9% of American Christians actually think according to what the Bible says, because we don't know what's in there. And we are presumptuous, and we think, well, this is what I think, and I'm a Christian, therefore that's what God thinks too. No, that's not necessarily true at all. And so in many areas, we don't recognize that. And this is one of the interesting things that I deal with on professors and others, is they say, well, the founding fathers are atheists, agnostics, and deists, and they didn't talk about God. And in their culture, they started reading the Bible in schools, and they read it from cover to cover, generally once a year. They knew it so well that they didn't have to tell each other that they were quoting from particular Bible verses. Everybody recognized it because everybody read that book thoroughly. And so in their rhetoric now, I love to take speeches of founding fathers and show it to pastors and say, pastors, how many Bible verses do you recognize? And usually they can only see about one-fourth of the Bible verses the founder actually quoted in that speech. And these are pastors. And these are, now we're talking about political leaders who quote the Bible four times more often than pastors do. So the concept of having the biblical worldview, we don't focus on it today. As a matter of fact, it's one of the interesting things that I'm doing a piece right now analyzing John Locke's work that was used to write the Declaration. And if I used the phrase nursing fathers, you'd go, what? It's mothers that nurse. There's not nursing. That is the most common phrase used in the sermons of the founding era because that comes out of two Bible verses, and it says that your civil governors are to be nursing fathers. In other words, they're to have the same nurture and care of people that mothers have for their children. The civil leaders are to do that for them. So nursing fathers, no Christian would get that today if they saw that. And yet the founders had sermon after sermon after sermon on that, and the founders themselves write letters about that. But what you will not find back in their generation is John 3:16. That was not a verse they talked about. Not that they didn't know it, but today that's the only verse that, you know, we hang that in the end zones. So our biblical literacy is so much reduced from what previous generations had. And I love even using Ben Franklin, the least religious founding father, quotes the Bible much more often than any minister I know today. And so until we get back to that type of thinking, we will never understand that the Bill of Attainder clause in the Constitution comes out of Ezekiel 18, nor that the treason clause comes out of Deuteronomy 17, nor all the other parts of the Constitution come out of the Bible. And if you don't understand that, you can't use it the way it's designed, and you'll never get the maximum benefit that they intended.
Dave, I want a quick follow-up before Gary gets a question here to you. Today, for instance, as we speak, there is a pro-life rally going on. Vice President Pence was speaking during this last break. He was speaking and addressing the folks there in Washington, the matter of life. I hear the word life, I look right directly to the beginning of our Declaration of Independence, where we are endowed by our Creator with life and liberty. Now, tie that together with the understanding of biblical principles, biblical worldview. And is it possible for anybody to really understand the Declaration of Independence or really understand the Constitution if they don't have a grasp of certain biblical principles?
Not really. And even as you talk about life, people say, well, that just means life in general. You know, you have the right to enjoy your life. No. That dealt with abortion. We have the specific writings of the Founding Fathers dealing with abortion. James Wilson, who was a signer of the Declaration and the Constitution, helped draft that document. He was part of that Congress who did that. He signed that document. He created the first law book in America, first law school in America, and he specifically says that life begins as soon as the infant is able to stir in the womb. And at that point in time, the common law protects that life in the womb. That's the role of government. And he talks about abortion. You see, all that's changed with abortion is that we change our technology. The issue is not new. They dealt with the issue back then. The reason they dealt with it was even 3,000 years before that, God dealt with it in his laws in the Bible, telling you what you cannot do with unborn children in the womb in the way of damage and killing, etc. So abortion's been there since the beginning of time. And so when the Declaration talks about that, yes, we are talking abortion. Now what happens is progressives always, and I've got letters from congressmen, And you say, a great example is Roe v. Wade came down, and people said, whoa, wait, the Declaration says there's a right to life. Congressman, head of Judiciary Committee, 52 years in Congress, Democrat, writes back and says, no, in Congress we take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not the Declaration. Constitution says nothing about life, and that's what we swear to uphold.
Mm.
Hey, Bubba, you don't know what you're talking about. Article 7 of the Constitution incorporates the Declaration fully. You're supposed to be upholding both according to the Constitution. But in anti-slavery days, we say, hey, there's a right to liberty. And the Democrats at that time said, no, that's the Declaration. We don't do the Declaration. We do the Constitution. And there's no right to liberty in the Constitution. Well, you're not supposed to separate the two. And today we say, wait a minute, natural marriage, it's a man and a woman. That's a law of nature. Oh, wait a minute, law of nature is in the Declaration. We don't do the Declaration. We just do the Constitution. So what happens is progressives want to shut out all the values and then reinterpret the documents without any values, and they impose their own values in it. And that's where you get this activist judiciary that comes up with all these new beliefs, is because they want to reject the biblical values that are inherent to those documents and create and replace their own values in those places.
You know, David, I've been appalled here just in recent days since Donald Trump has been in the White House, how many times I've heard a congressman or a senator make some sort of a statement that is far, far, far detached from the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. I don't think that they know either one of those documents very, very well. And they just go ahead and they opine and they speak forth these things, and they have no constitutional foundation or no foundation in the Declaration to speak those things. It's like we have a whole group of, I don't like to use this word, but imbeciles sometimes in government in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, let me give you a perspective on that. And first off, we have, and I had to be careful, I'm going to repeat your word, we have imbeciles in America. Only one out of 1,000 Americans, one out of every 1,000 Americans can name the five freedoms in the First Amendment. Now, that's freedom of free exercise of religion. Only one out of 1,000 can name the five freedoms there. But 19% of Americans say that the right to own a pet is guaranteed by the First Amendment. It's nowhere in there. We don't have a clue what that document says. Now, here's the deal. If you come to, we talked about immigration earlier. Our standard had been that if you come to America, you've been in the South Pole your whole life. You didn't even know America existed. You came north, you liked this place, you said, I want to live here. And we said, well, if you want to live here, you have to go to school for 3 months and learn about our government, learn about our history, take an immigration test. If you can pass that, you can live here. And so to pass that test, 91% of immigrants passed that test. We consider that to be the baseline of what you need to know to be a citizen. 91% of immigrants pass it. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute went through and took the 13 most basic questions off the test and gave them to Americans who have spent their entire life in America, who have gone through 12 years of American education. 71% of Americans could not answer the 13 most basic questions on the immigration test. But grab this. They gave those 13 questions to elected officials, and 78% of elected officials could not answer the 13 most basic questions on the 48% of elected officials could not name the three branches of government.
That
are
is
you
sad.
Kidding me?
And again, I ask the question, David, when did that begin to happen? I mean, is that just in our generation, or does that go back several generations when we have started to see an ignorant citizenry in the United States?
I talked earlier about how one of the changes progressive brought in the 1920s when they reshaped public education was they got us into group thinking. What they also did was they told us that we don't need to learn how to think, we need to learn how to learn. And so the emphasis, we used to teach students how to think, now we taught them how to learn, and what that means is the teacher is the focal point of all knowledge. You take what the teacher says and repeat it back. So in the 1920s is when we first introduced multiple choice and fill-in-the-blank and true-false tests, because that's designed to let you parrot back what the teacher taught you, which makes it very easy to indoctrinate. Prior to that, you had to know the subject. You read the original documents. You studied those documents. You did what were called forensics and catechisms on the documents. They're all designed to teach you how to think independently. But what happened was in the 20s, the progressives go, we are the source of all knowledge. We want you to repeat back what we tell you. And so what happens is they no longer use original source documents in what they do. We will tell you that the First Amendment guarantees a separation of church and state. You know, when I read that document, I can't find that anywhere. Oh, no, believe us, we're the teachers. We know what we're saying. And so since the 1920s, that's where it's really changed, and that's why we no longer know the documents.
Well, David, I tell you, that's excellent, excellent material. And when we come back, obviously, we're going to talk about how to fix some of this, because in reality, there's a disconnect. What you're talking about, we have people who think they know who don't know anything. And we have people who are supposed to be telling the truth and teaching, pulpits, schools, well, right? And they're evidently not doing it either. We're going to talk about solutions to this issue when we come back right after this break, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Stand in the Gap today. Sam Rohr, Gary Dalt, special guest David Barton.
At the American Pastors Network, we urge pastors and Christian parents to seek a Christian education for their children, not as a preference, but a conviction. Whether in homeschool or Christian school, a Christian education is essential if we ever hope to raise godly children and change the culture for Christ. That's why on this program and our Stand in the Gap Today program, we are glad to partner with BJU Press, the nation's largest provider of K-12 Christian curriculum, academically excellent, biblically sound, and historically accurate. Hello, this is Sam Rohr. Although the term Christian education doesn't occur in the Bible, it does speak of the moral and spiritual instruction of children. It places a high value on knowledge, both of God and His works. It describes the moral and spiritual fruits of this knowledge and defines its ultimate purpose, the growth of your child in godliness of character and action. That's why we suggest you consider BJU Press K-12 materials. Your child's a unique individual created for a specific purpose. Proper instruction that includes the Bible and the relational influence of godly teachers produces a pure heart and a willing mind. The Bible calls that success. BJU Press materials are well-written, grade-level appropriate, and biblically integrated. They teach critical thinking skills and keep your child engaged and excited about learning. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com. We're going to go now into our final segment in just a few moments. We've been listening to an interview with Christian historian David Barton. In this next selection, we're going to discuss the steps necessary to restore an understanding of the biblical and constitutional principles on immigration and other key issues. Now, if you've tuned into any of our daily programs this week, you'll know that we've talked frequently about what the Bible has to say about immigrants and immigration. Unfortunately, far too many Christians generally, and pastors specifically, simply do not understand Scripture or our history or our Constitution. And when the pulpits do not communicate the truth, people and nations go astray and go into sin, just as Israel of old did. One of the most fundamental and critical biblical truths is in regard to the entire concept of authority and the unique roles of each, the individual, the family, the civil government, and the church. Perhaps the most simple but profound biblical truth I've found is that the role of civil government is not the same as the role of the church, and the role of the church is not the same as the role of civil government. This is particularly applicable when considering the issue of immigration, when so many people want to believe that to deny entrance to some immigrants is a violation of the biblical command to love your neighbor or to show compassion to the downtrodden. But nothing is simpler or further from the truth. I'd like to take just a moment to lay out a few truths before we proceed to the last segment. The Bible makes it clear in Romans 13 that civil government is responsible for two primary things. First, to praise and reward those who do what's right according to the civil law and God's moral law, so that those who live responsible moral lives can continue to do so in peace. Secondly, to punish those who do evil by swiftly carrying out justice within the law against those who break it. But this twofold duty includes protecting the citizens from those who would harm them or their property or their families. This makes it clear that if civil government officials do not enact justice or do not take precautions against knowingly inviting in people such as Sharia-supporting Muslims who by their own teachings can never assimilate and are obligated to destroy our nation, our Constitution, and to subdue or kill all Christians and Jews, then these same government officials would be in violation of their biblical obligation and guilty of treason under our own civil law. Now, in contrast, the Bible makes it clear that the church is to spread the gospel and make disciples of all nations. The church is to care for the poor and the downtrodden. As individuals, we are to love our neighbors and to lead them to Christ. Yet for the church to oppose the biblical duty of government or to insist that government do the duty of the church, then judgment from God will occur, death and destruction will result, and freedom will be lost. There are four distinct jurisdictions, each of which are part of God's ordained authority structure for society. These are the individual, the family, the church, and civil government. None can take the jurisdiction of the other legitimately, and to do so is to violate God's plan for the nations. Folks, it must be understood that President Trump is indeed fulfilling his responsibility to protect our country, both biblically and constitutionally. In his inaugural address, he swore to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. Now, let me answer some questions here about the travel ban he's put in place. There are questions I addressed during a recent conference call with our pastors. As I've already demonstrated, the civil government's role of protecting its citizens is biblical. Our program here with David confirmed that it's constitutional. But what about these other questions? Is denying immigrants who will not assimilate or who hold ideologies which commit them to undermining, attacking, and overthrowing our Constitution and our freedom appropriate? The answer is yes. Is it extreme? No. Is it unprecedented? No. Is it anti-Muslim? No. Is it appropriate? Absolutely yes. Now, let's find out now what we can be do and what can be done to teach the things that we've lost and what can be done to restore God's blessing on our blessed land. Stay tuned as we complete this next important section.
Now, as we wrap up the program today, we've covered a lot of ground. We were talking most recently about biblical principles, a biblical worldview. You were talking about how progressive education has really changed the whole process of what ought to be education, taking it from thinking to learning and rote type of thing. You went into that. But David, the pulpits of America played a critical, critical role in teaching and laying out fundamental biblical principles. Speak to this issue a little bit from the standpoint of what we need to do, what America needs to do now in order to reacquaint ourselves with these biblical principles and biblical worldview that, as you said so clearly, at one point were so commonly understood that people didn't have to give the biblical quotes for them all the time because people understood that. Where do we start right now in this country with where we are right now?
One of the things we can do is study some of the old things. And one of the things that we've done at Wall Builders is we put up about 300 old sermons from the founding era and from the first and second Great Awakenings online for people and hopefully pastors to read. Because today in this age and culture, we kind of think that the Bible is limited toward just getting people converted. And it wasn't. Jesus was all about making disciples of all men. The Great Commission didn't say go get them converted. It said make disciples of them. All right, that means we have to cover Matthew 19, the extensive teaching he gave on no-fault divorce. When was the last time any pastors hit a no-fault divorce sermon? That also means covering Matthew 20 and the teaching that covers what we call minimum wage and what the government's supposed to do with wages, what it's not supposed to do. That also involves Luke 19 and what we call the capital gains tax, where that Jesus lays out very clearly that if someone makes a profit, you reward them. You don't penalize them. You penalize the folks who are not productive. We get that exactly wrong in policy. We can see what Jesus taught in John 8 about the right to confront your accuser. That confrontation clause is what we call it. Historical commentaries and current commentaries today all point to the fact that that part of the Bill of Rights came out of Jesus' teaching in John 8. I don't think I've ever heard a sermon on any of those four topics, and yet historically we did. And so pastors need to go back and say, you know what, guys? The Bible has a whole lot more to say than just how to say the sinner's prayer, which isn't even in the Bible. And so that's part of the reshaping is getting Christian leaders to reshape the way they look at it. I'm part of a group where we'll call between 500 and 600 churches every day asking them questions. And we ask them questions, and from that we can tell if they're Bible-believing churches or not. So currently out of 344,000 senior pastors in America, only 28% of current pastors believe the Bible. Then when you ask
David, I'm going to interrupt you again. You made an astounding statement. Please repeat that statement so our listeners can hear that.
Out of 344,000 senior pastors in America, only 28% say they agree with and believe the Bible. So 3 out of 4 churches have leaders who do not agree with or do not believe the Bible.
Hmm. And David, let me just throw this in too. You've got us going here. But that doesn't even mean that they believe in the authority of the Scripture. Believing in the Bible does not mean the same thing as having a biblical worldview, does it?
Oh, well, what we find is that among that group that say they believe the Bible, less than half of them have a biblical worldview.
That's the point.
So,
mm-hmm.
And actually, with that group, when we ask that group of what we'll call them Bible-believing pastors, because that's what they think they are. They believe the Bible. Those who say the Bible is where they take their marching orders, when we ask that group, how do you know whether your church is successful or not? How do you measure success at your church? The top 5 answers, not a single one of them comes out of the Bible. They measure whether their church is successful on how much money comes into the offering, how many people are filling the seats on Sunday morning, how much staff they have, how much square footage is under roof, and how many programs they offer. I don't think I remember Jesus being concerned about any of those 5 with this. As a matter of fact, it was just the opposite in John 6. He had huge crowds, but then he offended them all, and they all left and turned to the disciples and said, you guys going to leave too? And said, no, you got the words of truth. We'll hang with you. Jesus was all the time offending people, not because he tried to, but because he always told the truth. Mm-hmm. But they would come back. He'd get huge crowds, and then he'd make them all mad again, and they'd leave. And say, guys, you know, mm-hmm.
Sounds like my church.
Exactly. And that's what, if you're not offending people, you're not telling the truth, because that's where growth comes from, is having to challenge those things. And so the paradigm in America, even among Bible-believing pastors right now, is they have been told by seminaries that you shouldn't be offending people. You want to bring peace. Please show me the Bible references for that. Mm-hmm. I would love to see the Bible. But see, we buy into this, and that's why we try to send people back to read those old sermons. Because it will revolutionize what a pastor should do when you see that old stuff.
So, David, so here is a quick question. We've got a couple minutes left, and I'm going to have you pray here at the end. However, we've talked about it on this program from the standpoint of making America great again is a great goal. We actually started this program about it, and we talked about a couple of the items of immigration and borders control. Those are important for making a nation a nation. But in reality, David, can our nation ever really be great again without a renewed pulpit in America?
Yes, it can be without a renewed pulpit, but not without a renewed spirit. I'll point out that the Great Awakening that we talk about as having saved America occurred outside the church. The pastors refused to go along with it. They would not let Whitfield come into their churches to preach. That's why so much of the Great Awakening happened in outside meetings. The church didn't want to be part of it. So it cannot happen without a spiritual renewal, and it would be really nice if pastors wanted to be part of that. It can happen without them, and it has happened without them before the First and Second Great Awakening. Some pastors participated. Most refused to get involved. So the answer is yes. Without the church, it can happen. That's not the preferable way. God would rather have his shepherds involved. But it cannot happen without God, and that's what it's going to take to make America great again, which means every individual citizen.
And, David, with that, I'm going to ask you to pray for our pastors, pray for our nation here in these remaining moments of the program. We close the program in prayer. I'd like for you to be able to do that for us. Would you do it, please?
You bet. Father, thanks for the nation you've given us and blessings we enjoy that we don't even know where they came from. And help us to learn the source of those blessings. Help us to learn what we can do to be good stewards of what you've given us so we can preserve those blessings. Because it's not just for us. It's for the rest of the world. The rest of the world is blessed when America is strong. We send help to places that would never get it without that. So help us to be good stewards here and help our pastors to relearn their responsibility, to relearn their purpose, to not be hirelings, but to be shepherds, and to speak with that clarion voice of boldness that your leaders always used through the Scriptures. And help all of us as believers to know those Scriptures and to get back into your Word and even to commit to reading that once every year, which used to be our tradition in America. Just help us to know you and your Word so that we can see the power that comes from knowing that Word and change this nation, change the world, in Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you, David Barton. For those who want to know, go to wallbuilders.com. for lots of information about David Barton and his organization.
You've been listening to Stand in the Gap Weekend, a ministry production of the American Pastors Network. If you like what you're hearing, you can listen to our daily program online by visiting our website at standinthegapradio.com. That's standinthegapradio.com. You can listen live daily to Stand in the Gap Today from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time right there on our site, or you can look for a station in your area on our station listings page. We also have a one-minute program called Stand in the Gap Minute, which is a daily reflection on spiritual truths designed to help you in your walk with God. All three programs, Stand in the Gap Minute, Stand in the Gap Today, and Stand in the Gap Weekend, can be found at standinthegapradio.com. Just click on the name of the program that you're interested in to access the archives. Maybe this is the first time that you've heard about the American Pastors Network and you're wondering what we're all about. Our mission is to identify, encourage, educate, and equip pastor and church leaders and believers to stand in the gap for truth. We live in a day and age where the truth is sold on the street corners in exchange for political correctness, cultural permissiveness, and temporal satisfaction. But the Word of God tells us to buy the truth and sell it not. It's time that truth is no longer up for sale. It's time for God's people to engage and actively pursue righteousness, not only on the political and social level, but on a personal and spiritual level. And we're here to help. Specifically, our network has a goal of establishing state chapters of courageous and obedient pastors in all 50 states. Currently, we have networks in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Missouri, with over a half dozen more poised to join us in just the next several months. Now, it costs about $10,000 to launch a state chapter, so your financial gift of any amount will go a long way towards helping us to accomplish this most important mission. As our way of saying thanks for your gift of any amount, I'll send to you the Patriot's Essential Pocket Guide containing a copy of the documents that outline our freedoms written by our founding fathers. And for a gift of $250 or more, we'll send to you a beautiful leather edition of the Founders Bible with the American Pastors Network logo stamped on it. Now, this is a $125 value. This Bible was produced by our guest today, David Barton, and is an excellent resource that you'll use time and time again. Now, to give, you can call us at 610-901-3607. That's 610-901-3607. Or you can go to our website at standinthegapradio.com and press the donate button. To contact us or send your card or check to, send it to the American Pastors Network, 83 West Main Street, Suite 3, Elverson, Pennsylvania, 19520. That's American Pastors Network, 83 West Main Street, Suite 3, Elverson, Pennsylvania, 19520. America is at a crossroads, and God's people hold the key, but the pulpits of America must lead the way. Would you help us at the American Pastors Network now to stand in the gap for truth? I hope to hear from you this week. Until next time, stand in the gap for truth wherever you are.
Thank you for listening to Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network Week in Review. Our goal is to equip the pastor, church leader, and all believers to think critically and biblically in a culture that increasingly rejects truth, and to provide you with a focused analysis of current events viewed through the lens of a biblical and constitutional worldview. APN promotes the return of our nation to God through preaching, praying, and equipping Christians to reclaim the culture as soldiers and ambassadors of Christ. God hears the calls of His people who learn the truth and obey it. To partner with APN, please visit us on the web at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. That's AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. You can sign up to receive regular updates, to become a prayer partner, or to help as a financial partner. You may also call us at 610-901-3607. Again, that's 610-901-3607. To listen to any of our Stand in the Gap programs, including our live daily program, go to standinthegapradio.com. That's standinthegapradio.com. Thank you for listening today, and be sure to tune in next week at this same time for Stand in the Gap Weekend, the American Pastors Network. Pastors preaching the truth, equipping their people to impact the culture for Christ.